Join us on a journey of discovery with Dr. Elliot Swartz, principal scientist specializing in cultivated meat at the Good Food Institute. With experience spearheading projects across food safety, environmental impact, and the cultivated meat value chain, Elliot offers diverse perspectives that enrich our discussion on cultivated meat and seafood. Explore the current state of animal agriculture, what we mean by cultivated meat, how it differs from conventional meat, and the profound benefits of replacing conventional meat with cultivated alternatives for consumers, manufacturers, animals, and the planet. Discover how alternative seafood reduces health risks, improves efficiency, production, and the supply chain, and why these breakthroughs hold tremendous promise for marine ecosystems, human health, and sustainability. Gain insights into opportunities and challenges facing the cultivated meat industry, the role of open access research, and how various stakeholders can support this transformative field. Explore inspiring case studies showcasing how the Good Food Institute supports organizations in addressing these challenges innovatively, potentially shaping the future of food sustainability. Learn how the safety of cultivated meat and seafood products is determined, current regulatory pathways and safety considerations, opportunities for improvement and progress, significant regulatory breakthroughs from 2023, and anticipated progress for this year. Listen now to discover the current global landscape of cultivated meat and seafood, opportunities to learn more and get involved, and critical steps we can take to support sustainability, benefiting our planet, our health, and the health and welfare of animals worldwide, all from a renowned expert on cultivated meat and seafood and an innovative organization.
Hello, and thanks so much for joining. I'm very excited that Dr. Elliot Swartz, principal scientist of cultivated meat at the Good Food Institute, is here with us today. Elliot, thanks so much for joining. Can you tell us a little bit
about what you do? Thanks for having me, Aaron.
Wonderful. Really
excited. Sure. Yeah. So my work at GFI is basically focused on understanding what are the technical and economic bottlenecks that are facing the cultivated meat industry. And so while we don't have research labs ourselves, we dive really deeply into how the technology is being developed, what it might look like in the future, and what is preventing it from basically entering the marketplace at scale successfully.
Fantastic. I think for our listeners, it'd be great to talk a little bit about the context for your work. Can you tell us about the current state of animal agriculture, including things like land use and efficiency, what we mean when we're talking about cultivated meat, and how cultivated meat differs from traditional meat?
Sure. Yeah, it's a good starting point. So humanity right now produces and consumes a lot of meat. So the numbers right now are nearly 500 tons meat and seafood are consumed annually. And this is beginning to have quite the toll on the environment and on other sort of climate related elements. For instance, producing all of this meat basically uses about 75% of the world's agricultural land. However, that only yields about 18% of the protein that humanity consumes, as well as 37% of the calories. This also has the consequence that it's a leading cause of deforestation, especially in the tropics. It's a leading cause of biodiversity loss. And it's also a large contributor to eutrophication, which leads to dead zones in oceans at the mouths of rivers all around the world. In terms of efficiencies, this is really what the problem is. And so if you think about efficiency, we grow a lot of crops to feed to animals and then eat those animals. And in the process, you're losing a lot of energy. So for instance, when you take chicken as an example, which is generally considered to be the most efficient form of meat production, it takes about 9 calories of feed to get 1 calorie back. And so that's similar to basically having, you know, 10 bowls of spaghetti on your table and throwing 9 of them away before just eating the one. If you look at cultivated meat, the whole idea conceptually is that we can remove the animal from the equation and still get the meat that we want. And so cultivated meat is genuine animal meat that is grown from the cells of animals but without the need for animal slaughter. So at a high level, the process basically works by taking a small sample from an animal. It could be their muscle tissue or their fat tissue. It could be a living animal, or it could be an animal that was recently slaughtered, which might be important for some religious considerations like halal, for instance. But nevertheless, those cells can be taken back into the lab. Those cells can be selected for the types that you want, or the types that basically can create meat, which is muscle, fat, and connective tissue. And then those cells are fed a nutrient mix that's essentially what your cells in your body need to survive. So things like glucose and amino acids and vitamins and minerals. And they're grown in a vessel that's a stainless steel tank that is similar to what you'd find in like a brewing facility. And growing those cells at larger scales essentially allows you to produce a large amount of them. At some point, those cells can be turned into muscle, fat, or connective tissue, and then combined into a final product that is basically very similar or replicates the sensory and nutritional profiles of conventional meat. And just a little bit more on, in terms of what we know about these processes right now, it's estimated that from an efficiency standpoint, which again is the underpinning of why we want to sort of transition into a new way of producing meat, is that if you look at it from a caloric perspective, it's estimated that about 3 to 4 calories would be needed to put into a cultivated meat process to get 1 calorie back. So that's between 2 and 3 times more efficient than chicken. Of course, this needs to be, I think, verified at scale, but that's how some of the early estimations break out. And finally, there's numerous environmental benefits that could be as a consequence of this efficiency as well.
So I want to make sure we've unpacked a number of important things that you just mentioned. And please correct me if I am mischaracterizing anything you just said. But essentially, when we look at the current state of animal agriculture, when we're thinking about what this looks like, what this all entails, why we're talking about cultivated meat at all, a huge part of it has to do with the resources that go into creating what we see as a meat product. And essentially, the tremendous amount of feed land that can lead to deforestation and other environmental concerns, as well as the other elements essentially that come to bring a whole animal to the time and state of slaughter, and then slaughtering that animal and offering that product on the market, as opposed to cultivated meat, where we're essentially starting with cells from an animal. And we can go into some questions later in terms of what that process looks like. But essentially, working from cells allows this process to be much more efficient from a production perspective, but also allows us to avoid many of these challenges when we're talking about the environment and sustainability, particularly deforestation, when we're talking about the sheer amount of time, space, land, all of the efforts that are required to bring animals to that time frame of slaughter, and also has animal welfare benefits when we think specifically about the slaughter experience as opposed to cultivating cells directly and growing those cells. Am I hearing you right so far?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think just to go into a little bit more detail, in terms of why, you know, I think, and we at the Good Food Institute think that these sorts of technologies are necessary, is essentially that people have known about animal agriculture's basically environmental impact and animal welfare issues for a long time, but convincing people to go vegan or vegetarian just hasn't really been taking off. The numbers are generally the same as they were several decades ago. And so we think that by giving people the meat that they know and love without having to make a large behavioral change, has the highest likelihood of success in actually driving adoption of meat production method that it has much less of an environmental and animal welfare toll. It's also worth mentioning that the numbers that I stated are today's numbers, but the population continues to grow. And as countries increase their incomes, their diets tend to shift towards more meat heavy diets. And so it's predicted that by the year 2050, that we might actually need about 70% to 100% more meat production. And so while the situation is already pretty bad in terms of what animal agriculture's toll is, it's predicted to get worse, like nearly double in the next few decades without any sort of mitigation in place. And so it's basically scientific consensus at this point that if we don't mitigate animal agriculture, if we just do business as usual, then even if you stopped literally every fossil fuel from being produced and burned today, then you'd still run far above the Paris Climate Agreement of 1.5 degrees Celsius. And so we really need solutions that can be scalable and that have a chance of being adopted broadly by the human population. So I'll just reiterate that in terms of like the urgency of the situation at play. And yeah, in terms of what you were saying in, with respect to efficiency, I think what people need to understand is that with cultivated meat, you're growing just the cells that you want to consume. There's no, unless you want to have a bone, you don't need the bone, you don't need the hair, you don't need the organs. You don't have the animal basically living its life and burning all this fuel or this energy. You're just putting in what you need, what those cells need to grow, and you're having minimal energy loss in terms of heat along the way. And so that's really conceptually what underlies cultivated meat, and it stands on the shoulders of stem cell biology and other technologies that have been developed over the past few decades, where now we feel that it's gotten to a point where, hey, we can start to maybe scale this up significantly and use it not just for human medicinal or regenerative medicine purposes, but actually for food production as well.
Thank you for clarifying that. And so in hearing this additional detail, I think number one, it's clear that manufacturers and those in the industry stand to benefit in terms of a streamlined operational process, in terms of being able to devote resources to the product. And while this may require substantial investment up front, that there are plenty of benefits in terms of simplifying that process from start to finish, in terms of being able to focus directly on the cultivated meat itself. Certainly in terms of the sustainability and planetary benefits, both in terms of addressing the issues you've mentioned and also recognizing that demand for meat is only predicted to increase. And with population growth, these problems today become even more urgent and of a greater magnitude as we think about the next decade, and certainly in terms of the animals involved. Can you talk a little bit more about the consumer side? I think this is a particularly interesting area. And when we think about the potential benefits, as you mentioned, really focusing on continuing to give people the products that they love and recognize that this is different than the products that are on the market today from a variety of lenses. I would love to hear your thoughts a little bit more in terms of what are the benefits for consumers?
Yeah, so I'll just start by saying in terms of what consumers, like just placing the development of this technology right now on a timeline, I think it's important for people to realize that it's still early days in the development of cultivated meat. For example, the first product was approved in Singapore in 2020. And then last year, there were two products approved in the United States. And at the beginning of this year, 2024, there was one product that was approved in Israel, but is not yet on sale. And so there are several other products that are waiting in line in the United States and Singapore, but suffice to say, it's not very accessible right now. And it's likely that will remain true for the next few years. And so we're still learning about what these products are going to look like. But in general, this is, as mentioned before, real animal meat. And so the sort of compositional or nutritional analysis tends to be very similar to conventional animal meat. So people that eat meat for different nutritional reasons, that is expected to be very similar. Of course, there might be some differences in terms of, let's say, vitamin B12, which is found in the guts of animals, but those things can be easily added in terms of fortification if needed. For the consumer themselves, I think it's going to be interesting. Right now, plant-based meat products, the goal with plant-based meat products is to basically biomimic meat using plant ingredients. And that has proven to be pretty challenging. There are some companies that have gotten pretty close, like Impossible Foods, that have this heme ingredient that gives it a more sort of bloody or meaty aroma. And those tend to score fairly close on sensory panel tests with actual conventional meat. But for the most part, plant-based meat products are still struggling in terms of taste and other sort of sensory components for the consumer. Now, that tends to get flipped on its head when cultivated meat is involved. And of course, we don't have that much data on this yet. But in terms of anecdotal experience from people that I've talked to, as well as personal experience with trying these products, tasting really becomes believing, because once you have those actual animal cells in the product, then you really begin to be convinced that this is meat, because it is. So I think that's going to be most interesting in terms of, a lot of people might look at this in terms of food neophobia, and this is interesting, this is weird, this is new. But I think tasting is really going to be believing for a lot of consumers. In terms of the products that we can expect, generally from a complexity standpoint, it's easier to create a chicken nugget and a sausage compared to a steak. And so we expect that these sort of unstructured products are going to be predominant in the early stages throughout this decade, at least. We also expect that from a cost perspective, which is really one of the limiting factors right now, is cost and scale, that in order to get costs down to things that are tolerable for the average consumer, that we're probably going to have to blend these cultivated animal cells with other plant-based ingredients. And so, similar to how electric vehicles came onto the marketplace, where battery costs were very high, prevented access for electric vehicles to the average consumer. So hybrid cars were invented, where you blend the battery with existing fossil fuel powered engines. And so we expect that these, what we call hybrid products, where you have blends of cultivated meat and plant-based proteins in there, are going to be the predominant type of product that enters the market. And that essentially this might allow us to combine the best of both worlds right now, which is that, let's say if you take animal fat, which has a lot of the sort of sensory elements and taste elements that meat contains, and you add that to an otherwise plant-based meat product that is fairly good on texture, but maybe struggling in the taste department, then you can create these hybrid products that get you very much closer to what the real meat experience is for the consumer. And so that, I think, is what we expect over the course of, let's say, this decade in terms of the types of products that will be entering the marketplace. Now, in terms of benefits for the consumers themselves, I think this is going to be interesting to track, because I think right now talking about replacing meat is really, I think, far away, because the scales at which this is going to be produced, it's, like I said, millions of metric tons. None of that infrastructure really exists right now. And so it's going to be a slow ramp up over time. So I think it's important not to state that this is like a silver bullet type of solution. But over time, if this does begin to substitute in the diets, I think, for conventional meat for consumers, then I think it could play a really important role in mitigating a lot of things related to climate change, and environmental impact of conventional meat production, other environmental damage, water pollution, air pollution, et cetera. Things like antibiotic resistance and zoonotic disease. So we spend about 3/4 of the world's antibiotics feeding to animals right now instead of humans, and that's becoming a larger driver of antibiotic resistance. Cultivated meat can be produced entirely without antibiotics. And so that alone is, I think, worth pursuing just in terms of the potential benefits. Zoonotic disease, right now we have a pathogenic avian flu that's spreading into dairy cattle throughout the United States and around the world. Different mammalian species are being infected, and so it can easily cross barriers into humans, and has in some cases already. And so we are really sleepwalking into the next pandemic by continuing to grow animals in very confined conditions. And of course, cultivated meat basically takes that risk down to zero. And then finally, one thing that I think not a lot of people think about is this is produced in a very controlled and basically what we call aseptic environment. And so the amount of pathogenic bacteria that is, you know, this exposed to these products, things like E. coli or Salmonella or Campylobacter, these sort of enteric bacteria that lives in animal guts, those are completely out of the equation. And so foodborne illness is expected to be very low. You can have shelf lives potentially with these products that are much higher, which could impact how products are transported, the cold chain, getting products into inland areas, having fresh seafood in the middle of the country. So all these sorts of things can provide, I think, unique benefits to consumers. But of course, that this is all going to have to play out over many years.
Thank you for sharing that. I want to highlight a few things that you mentioned, particularly from the lens of thinking. We talked a lot about the greater good type benefits of cultivated meat, whether we're thinking about the planet, whether we're thinking about forest, whether we're thinking about sustainability, whether we're thinking about animals, and certainly the industry. When it comes to the consumer lens, always want to make sure we're asking the question, what's in it for the consumer? And I think there are a few really important things that you mentioned. Even if none of the things we've talked about so far resonate with a particular person, and one of those is that there are major antibiotic concerns when it comes to the current state of the industry, and this takes those out of the equation. The second is that availability increases, right? So you mentioned that there may be products like cultivated seafood, which we'll talk about in just a moment, that could be available in parts of the country or the world that wouldn't otherwise be available through this approach. And then certainly thinking about the production process is you're removing a lot of the concerns from a health perspective, from a sanitation perspective, when we think about the process of growing and having an animal in a shared environment with other animals, and then a traditional meat product as compared to the process involved with cultivated meat. So we're taking out disease risk and we're taking out other concerns because we can ensure a clean environment. And we'll certainly talk about other factors when it comes to approvals for the human side, but wanted to at least highlight a few of those key benefits from that very individual kind of what's in it for me lens. We make sure we're looking at each layer of this conversation.
Yeah, and I think I'm not an expert in nutrition and things like that, but it gets brought up a lot. And basically, there's people that say, okay, meat is a very nutritionally dense food. That's a good thing. And then there are people that say some meat, especially red meats and processed meats, are linked to cancer and consuming too much of them, which is what we do in a lot of Western societies, especially in the United States, for sure. That's problematic. And so the question is, what does that look like for cultivated meat? I think the first generation of products basically are intended to match the nutritional profile as much as possible. But with cultivated meat, again, because you have so much of control over the production process, there's possibilities that you can actually improve the nutritional profiles of these products and remove some of the quote unquote bad things that might be in meat. Just some examples of that might be you can potentially, based on the nutrients that you feed the cells, then tune the nutritional property of the end product. And so maybe having omega-3 fatty acids in an actual beef burger, for instance, lowering the saturated fat quantities of certain products, and or removing allergens from the products as well. So those things are all, I think, on the table for future generations of the product. And I think from a consumer standpoint, I think the most important thing is just, it's not expected that you're going to have to make a sacrifice. I think that is the biggest potential with this product, because right now, the alternatives that are on the marketplace, of course, those are going to improve. But right now, as it currently stands, you're basically paying more for something that tastes, to a lot of people, not as good. And so the uptakes of these products are just, it's a slow go. And so we need more innovation to happen, which we expect certainly will occur and can occur. But cultivated meat, I think, just from a starting point, allows you to be at a level that is at or very close to the real thing from a quality sort of taste sensory perspective. And I think another thing, we mentioned a lot of these sort of meta benefits of getting rid of the conventional system has all of these maybe knock-on domino effects, the things that we don't necessarily think about too much. And I would just say another one of those is just air quality. If you live next to a large pork production facility or a feedlot, the air quality there is just horrendous. In a lot of poor, underserved communities, especially in the United States, that's where they get the shorter end of the stick and have to deal with that and the health consequences of that. Air pollution should be reduced quite substantially in a cultivated meat facility. And so you can have these facilities next door and probably not care too much about it. And you can have these facilities in rural areas, or you can also have them in urban areas as well. I think that changes the sort of dynamic of how we think about food production as well.
Absolutely agree. I think there are a number of different documentaries that help to speak to things you mentioned, including The Smell of Money. We can include some of those links for those that are interested in learning more about the concerns from a human health exposure perspective and that lived experience. I think that helps to better understand some of these situations at a more individual level, is to really be able to understand some of those individual stories of what it's like to live near a place where pigs are being raised and slaughtered, and what those environmental concerns are for those in the geographic area, what that means in terms of equity, what that means in terms of human health concerns, really major problems that I think many of us may only learn about when we have a chance to understand these from a documentary or a news story perspective. So thank you so much for sharing that. Want to ask one last question here in terms of the different stakeholders that stand to benefit before we switch gears into seafood. And that is related to a question that had come up in a previous podcast with Dr. Fritha Langford. And I would be remiss if I didn't ask this question, because it has to do with the animal lens that we've touched on briefly. And that is coming down to the cell process. So I'm paraphrasing what Dr. Langford had mentioned. When we think about the animal welfare side of this, a big question has to do with, what's the process we're following for getting those cells? And that would naturally look different if we're taking cells from a live animal as opposed to taking cells from an animal that's no longer living. Can you touch briefly on where the state of the cell process is today and where you see it going?
Sure. Yeah. I'll try not to go too deep into the complexities, because there's a lot of different cells that companies are using in the industry, and obtaining those can look differently depending on what you're getting. A cell, the easiest way to think about it is that a cell can come from a biopsy, and a biopsy can be done generally under like local anesthesia. So you might take a little muscle puncture or skin puncture from an animal. You could even take a blood draw or a cheek swab and then turn those cells into stem cells using technology that received a Nobel Prize a couple of years ago. And so it can look a little different, but generally speaking, unless you're taking from an extremely juvenile animal, which in some cases you might want to do because those cells tend to be more proliferative. If you're taking from an animal that's any substantial size, that animal can just go on and live its life and basically like nothing really happened. The size of the biopsy that you need is maybe something around like a sunflower seed or something like that, depending on what you're trying to obtain. And again, you can take it from cutaneous muscle or fat, et cetera. So there's a lot of different ways to do that. And there's a lot of literature on different protocols. And so there's not really a one size fits all approach. It's going to be dependent on the cell type you're looking to acquire. The type, size of the animal, the location of the biopsy could actually matter in terms of the quality of the cell that you're obtaining. So a lot of this is in development, but we've been biopsying animals for quite a number of years. And so I think from a technology standpoint, it's relatively well understood. And I think a lot of people also don't necessarily understand that this, you need like one animal. That's really all you need. These cells, what can basically adopt a phenotype, what's called immortalization. Cells can actually proliferate indefinitely in culture. And so you can actually feed the world with a single biopsy of cells, as long as those cells become immortalized. And there's different ways to immortalize a cell. Some of those ways include what we call spontaneous immortalization. After serial cell culture over time, cells can just acquire the ability to essentially divide indefinitely. And that is the generic, that's the predominant way that companies are producing cultivated meat today and intend to produce it in the future. And that basically would prevent you from needing to go back and biopsy an animal. Alternatively, you can genetically engineer or edit the cells. So doing targeted reconstruction of certain genes that can allow you to acquire this immortalized phenotype. I know these words sound scary, but in reality, it's actually not that complex. And basically, that allows you to do a very targeted way of producing immortalized cells, so you don't have to go back and biopsy the animals. However, in certain regulatory jurisdictions, which we'll talk about, that can be a longer pathway to regulatory approval. And so companies generally try to avoid that. And then finally, you can also take what are called primary cells. So those are basically taking a biopsy directly from the animal and throwing that into your production process. And that, therefore, you're basically using cells that haven't been grown in culture for a long time. They haven't adapted to cell culture, but they're just being basically thrown right into the process. And then you'd have to go back and biopsy the animal. And so some of the companies that are doing that actually envision that, hey, let's not eliminate what animal agriculture is for a lot of people. Let's have a smaller herds of animals that we can go back and biopsy and have them live basically a normal life until completion, but continue to have those animals and not necessarily disrupt the sort of livelihood or tradition of existing farmers. And I'll just say for farmers, since there's a question that comes up, it's like, where do they fit in? So if you're a farmer making crops, we're still going to need crops because these cells need to consume feed. And that feed can come from commodity crops like soy and glucose that comes from corn or sugar beet or sugar cane. And so there's a lot of opportunities for farmers to play a role in the supply chain from a feed perspective. Those same raw materials can also be used to feed microbes for what we call precision fermentation, which is another technology to make animal proteins without the animal, as well as for plant-based meat. And so I think there'll be opportunities to not only rely on these commodity crops that exist today, but also diversify the types of crops that we produce in the future and create something that is less monoculture and more diverse in terms of the needs of different products that might be created in the future. If you are an animal farmer, so if you're raising hundreds of thousands of chickens and barns or pigs and that sort of thing, there's not as much opportunity for you in this new paradigm of production. That's what I'll say. There are people that are thinking about, can we bring the equipment onto farms and sort of retrofit farms into these new production systems? I'm a little bit skeptical of that, but people are trying to imagine that future.
Thank you for sharing that information. I want to connect the dots between these two conversations on a few different levels and also acknowledge, as I try to do in every conversation, that part of this asking of questions is to make sure that people from all perspectives, all food choices, are having an opportunity to learn about cultivated meat and think about this from their own vantage point. As someone who was chatting with Dr. Langford from an animal science, animal welfare, ethics lens, I would say a few things that you mentioned certainly stand out in terms of the question around animals, and then also the broader conversation that we had around reducing meat choices as part of what's advocated in terms of the anticipated demand, the many factors that you have mentioned that we anticipate by 2050 and beyond, in terms of the current state of animal agriculture, in terms of supporting our own health and well-being. So to connect these dots a little bit, I'd say the first thing you mentioned is that there is a smaller number of animals involved when we think about those that would be involved in actually taking cells from the animal as compared to the number of animals living in these systems today. And that's not the only factor, as we had talked about with Dr. Langford. We want to think about the individual animal's experience. However, if we think about, say, a utilitarian ethical framework, we are trying to think about the positives and negatives and how those map for all involved. And so we can at least say there's fewer animals involved, even if there's some discomfort or problems involved in the state of cell removal today, and there's room for possible improvement on that, for instance, from animals that are no longer living as opposed to animals that are living, we're still talking about a far smaller number of animals because of the way that those cells can be used over time. We're also talking about a very different lived experience in the sense that we're taking the lived experience out of the process once those cells have been taken, because we're growing animal products, we're growing parts of animals, we're growing essentially, as you mentioned, the equivalent of parts that will be developed into things like what we see as a chicken nugget or other completed products, as well as particular
organs or parts of the animal without the animal living in the conditions that might be living in today in a broader system. When we think about the broader conversation for the planet, for human health, for any number of different benefits that we've already talked about here, one of the key takeaways that we know is advocated and that we're continuing to see more and more research supporting is to, particularly in the U.S., but certainly more broadly as well, to reduce the amount of animal products consumed on a daily and weekly basis. And so to your point about farmers, we're seeing a shift for many farmers in terms of diversifying crops, bringing in a variety of different plants for human consumption, not just the crops that are being developed for animal consumption. And that I anticipate, at least based on these conversations, that is not going away, certainly, and will only continue to be advocated and supported, given that we know many people are being advised to reduce animal products as part of their day-to-day food choices, irrespective of our conversation on the state of cultivated meat. So this is certainly a conversation that is inclusive of farmers, and I think there's a tremendous opportunity there when we think about the broader challenges, 2050 and beyond, and the opportunities. And cultivated meat is an important part of that equation. Plant-based foods are also an important part of that equation. As you mentioned, plant-based meat is certainly a part of that equation as you connected to farmers in your comments just now. And I just want to reiterate that we're talking about a technology and area of innovation that still needs time to develop, as you mentioned. So we also have to be thinking about what the state of the problem is today, what our opportunities are as consumers, as manufacturers, as people looking out for the planet and animals and all of these different lenses, and thinking about these comprehensively. So I see these conversations as integrally linked, and I want to make sure I'm saying these things out loud for those that are listening, saying, I know Aaron's a vegan, like how does all this fit together? It's, for me, I see cultivated meat as a win for animals, as a win for the planet, as a win for human health, and certainly manufacturing and efficiency and plenty of other benefits. It's going to take time, and we're going to talk about where things are and where things are going, and we have additional ways to empower ourselves with the choices we're making every day while it continues to take time. So I want to just bring those pieces together for anyone that's in any way thinking, I have some questions about how this conversation and this conversation fit together. I see them as integrally linked. And think if I were to summarize your points just now with a little bit of a more broad sweeping statement, it's to say, yeah, this is a little different. It's a lot different than the way that animals are being raised today. That's not to say that farmers aren't part of this equation. This is a process that involves tremendous opportunity. It's going to take time. And there are a variety of areas of focus that need attention in the meantime. And I would say in terms of the conversation with Dr. Langford, certainly that involves the way animals are cared for and raised today in farming systems as well. Is that anything that you want to add or clarify there?
Yeah, it's always important to, I think, frame the context of where all of these technologies are in different timelines. That includes, you know, any alternative protein products that people are working on developing. But I think, like, we compare alternative proteins a lot to renewable energy and electric vehicles because they basically slot into our existing behavior as humans, what we're doing today and consuming and how we're living our lives, without having to make a huge behavioral change. And therefore, you're doing good without necessarily realizing it. But I think a lot of people look at something like electric vehicles and just say, okay, this just drives us further into the need for cars and building infrastructure around cars and all of this sort of stuff. But these are not like single bullet solutions. Like, you shouldn't ever look at anything like cultivated meat or any of these new technologies as like the end all be all. You need to basically develop electric vehicles while at the same time advocating for cities that are more walkable and that are more dense, and for public transit and for trains and all of these sorts of things together. And so similarly in the food system, I think a good envision of the future is not one where Americans are consuming 120 kilos of meat per year, whether it's cultivated meat or normal meat. I think you want to together reach a world where there's less meat consumption overall, and you're moving toward a more plant-based diet that we know is more sustainable overall, and that we know can have numerous different, you know, benefits, whether it's on human health or on environmental health for the planet, and obviously for animals as well. So I think all of these things should be, yes, viewed as things that are operating together in a sort of complex shift over time. And certainly cultivated meat is producing hundreds of millions of metric tons of cultivated meat is certainly not going to happen overnight. And so we definitely need to be working on other things along the way, especially given the time frame that we have.
Great. Thank you for sharing that additional context. Let's switch gears to cultivated seafood, which we know is an important area of focus for the Good Food Institute and presents a lot of opportunities, as we've been already talking about, from a cultivated meat perspective, for industry, for academia, and for consumers. How does alternative seafood reduce health risks and improve efficiency, as well as provide benefits to production and the supply chain? And why does this matter when we're thinking about marine ecosystems, sustainability, and more?
Yeah, so just like commercial animal ag is really bad in a lot of ways, commercial fishing is in some ways even worse. I think if you're a consumer looking at cultivated seafood, some of the things you might care about is the potential that you have no heavy metal contamination. So mercury, for instance, no microplastics or reduced microplastics. Again, some of the data here is forthcoming, but this is what we expect. Reduced foodborne illness, as I mentioned before, this is a common thing with seafood, is a lot of people can get sick from eating seafood because it can spoil easily. And that is much more controllable for cultivated meat or seafood. I think another thing that people care about is supply chain traceability. And basically, a lot of seafood that you might be getting at a restaurant, sometimes it might not even be what you think it is. It's a very opaque, complex supply chain. There's illegal fishing and bycatch all the time on the open oceans because there's not much oversight. There's also slavery at sea, and that's been documented by commercial fishing operations and that sort of thing. Obviously, from a worker standpoint, it's a lot better. You don't have to be out on a boat, potentially literally as a slave working on these boats. And you can have full traceability throughout the supply chain and really know what you're consuming. So I think those are all a lot of potential positives when it comes to cultivated seafood. Obviously, there's sort of wild catch fishing and also aquaculture, which has become quite predominant method of seafood production over the last few decades. But that has its own animal welfare issues, that you're using a lot of antibiotics in those processes. You have disease, anything where you're basically crowding animals into an enclosed environment. You welcome disease, you welcome the use of antibiotics and animal welfare issues. And so all those things can be, again, mitigated and completely avoided really with switching to a cultivated meat production system. I think importantly, seafood is interesting because there's so many species that we eat. And so there's fewer cultivated seafood companies. And then they have to figure out, like, what should I be working on? What species can I focus on? Because there's so many to choose from. And it's, what do we need the most? So I think companies have different philosophies on this. Some people might look at something like tuna and say, these animals you can't farm them because they're basically apex predators in the ocean. We basically have to catch all of them from the wild. And so by doing so, we can decimate their populations pretty easily. So we might want to focus on tuna. Others, for salmon, similar reasons, maybe that's aquaculture and wild catch there. And then others are looking at species that are endangered, eel and things like this in Asia that's consumed in high quantities now, but also you can't farm them. And so there's a lot of different focus areas for cultivated seafood companies. But what is true across all of them is that the research is really early and it's more challenging. And there's not enough information out there in the existing scientific literature where you can just go and understand how to go and culture like tilapia cells. There's a lot of pre-existing knowledge on human cell culture, mouse cell culture, et cetera, that is fairly adaptable when you switch to like a cow or pig or chicken. But once you start moving further down the evolutionary ladder into seafood and crustaceans and things like that, invertebrates, it becomes a lot more challenging. And yeah, you mentioned GFI. We focused a lot on seafood explicitly because it's underserved. And so there's a lot of counterfactual impact that can be had by focusing on seafood, because we really need to basically elevate the foundation of where we're at today in terms of our understanding of just basic culture conditions for how to get these cells growing so that we can get everyone on a higher level of a starting point and we can see success more rapidly. And so there's a lot more basic research to do in the seafood realm than in the conventional animal ag realm, or animals that are used in conventional animal ag on land, let's say. And so, yeah, it's been a focus, but also a challenge for researchers for sure.
I know you've talked previously in terms of some of the materials available on your website about the important role that databases play, both for regulators and transparency for safety, which we'll talk about in a little bit, but also in terms of some of the challenges from a research perspective. Can you talk a little bit about the current data gaps that you're seeing and how these apply both to seafood and meat? What role does open access research play in all of this? And then how do universities and academic researchers stand to both benefit and contribute from sharing of data?
Yeah, so this is partially why GFI exists. So in the cultivated meat world, a lot of private capital was raised. There was a lot of excitement and hype over, oh, we can create meat from cells. Like, this is potentially revolutionary. A lot of people wanted to get in, and a lot of money was poured into that. But what ends up happening, which is predictable, is that you have a lot of private companies working in silos where they're essentially all doing the same type of research, but none of it's being published out in the open. So there's very little, you know, there's gains within companies, but there's not gains within the whole community of researchers. And so we have been advocating for a long time for increased public funding into cultivated meat and other alternative protein technologies. So the same level of support that governments played for renewable energy development or reduction in cost in different technologies like solar panels in the early days or batteries, you need that same level of support to get these alternative protein technologies to where they need to be. And so we basically skipped over this sort of foundational, you know, bedrock of information that you would otherwise have when you try to commercialize an industry and scale it up. And so cultivated meat in the public sphere is really playing catch up. I'm on the advisory board of the Tufts Industry Consortium. I've been on the external advisory board at research at UC Davis, which are two of the basically largest nucleus of researchers working on cultivated meat in the United States. And we see a lot of research globally as well, since we've been funding research for 5 years or so now. And I think generally speaking, the academic research is probably 5 or 6 years behind companies because they've had a lot of resources and scientists working on this for the interim time. So just a lot more money, a huge imbalance, basically, where we have to get more money pouring into the public sector, get more scientists working on these problems, get more scientists trained to go into the workforce as well, which is an important area that will become more of a bottleneck over time, we think. And so obviously all these things need to happen together as the industry becomes no longer nascent, but into something that's really producing product at any reasonable scale. You mentioned databases and lack of information, that sort of thing. And so I think there's a couple of like key areas. This is basically the job of what we think about is, what are the biggest bottlenecks or challenges? What are the biggest opportunities as well for new businesses to be formed? I think there's a couple of different segments of information gaps that exist today. One is that there's still not a lot of information on the end products themselves. And what is the nutritional profile? Does it have the same digestibility and bioavailability as conventional meat? How different is it from conventional meat? What sort of variants can we expect? So that's where something like these sorts of databases have been produced for other food categories. And that could really help just increase the amount of general knowledge that we have about these end products that a lot of people want to know. Now, some of this information is going to inevitably trickle out anyway, because at least in the United States, as products get approved, There's a whole hundreds of pages of information that gets approved, that gets released along with it, that has information on amino acid profiles and lipid profiles and micronutrient and all this sort of information that people want to know. But certainly it can be streamlined and happen much faster with the help of public researchers pouring that information into databases and things like that. So I think there's still a big opportunity there. And then there's data gaps and information gaps all along different places that of the value chain. As we mentioned before, seafood is way far behind. And so just basic culture conditions for how to grow seafood cultures or crustacean cultures, there's very little information on that now. What we were in a meeting the other day with the seafood community that we curate a little bit at GFI and have people meet each other and get in the same room and talk about their problems. And I think we talked about the need for sharing negative results. So what doesn't work? As I mentioned, all these companies are working in their own sort of silos and they're testing a lot of things. And a lot of those things don't end up working, but none of that goes out into the public either. So people just end up repeating the same mistakes over and over again. So there's a need for can we put a database together that just has negative results in it? So people don't spin the wheels on things that we know don't work. And then just a lot of things that can be done, but not enough time in the day for me or my colleagues, at least, to handle all of it. And so certainly we need governments to play an important role supporting larger research endeavors at universities. And some of this is starting to happen already, especially in Europe and in Asia. The US is a little bit behind, but still has begun to fund projects at some sort of scale, like in the millions of dollars. But yeah, overall, still very far behind of where we need to be.
The point you made about sharing what doesn't work or didn't work, I want to make sure I've repeated, because I think we know this is a challenge, the broader research environment. What gets published tends to favor experiments that worked and what we learned from those, and the need to create channels, to create the ability to share what didn't work and what we learned from those has been highlighted for a long time, whether we're thinking about publications, whether we're thinking about the way we share wins versus challenges in work environments. Like, we need to encourage sharing of learning, including things that didn't pan out the way we expected them to pan out. So really appreciate you sharing that. And definitely appreciate the role that you're playing in terms of bringing researchers together, certainly collaborating with industry and helping to bridge these gaps in light of the known data gaps and in helping to create pathways for that greater knowledge sharing, for sure. I'd love to delve into an example or two just to help our listeners better understand some of this work from a storytelling perspective. You mentioned Tufts University already and their collaboration, as well as Moat Marine Laboratory, are two that really resonated with me from your website. Can you walk us through some examples in terms of the challenges that researchers have been facing when it comes to limited existing cell lines and some ways that you're working in these types of collaborations and more to help address these challenges?
Yeah, I'd love to. So GFI, we're a nonprofit organization. We're funded entirely by philanthropy. And we're lucky because there's a couple of donors that have put forth significant funds that allow us to have a research grant program. And so that started about 5 years ago. And our research grant program is really intended to be catalytic, basically injecting funds into important research areas that will hopefully lead to more funds falling on, because right now there's just not a lot of opportunities. And you mentioned cell lines. Basically, the starting point for any research endeavor begins with the cells, and it begins with how to culture them. And as we mentioned before, it's really just not the case that there's a lot of existing cell lines from farmed animals or for animals from fish and crustaceans, et cetera. And basically, a lot of the projects that we've funded over the years are heavily skewed toward establishing this basic foundation of cell lines and cell culture conditions, like cell culture media formulations and everything. And yeah, Moat Marine is one of the groups that we've funded, which is a group in Florida. And they are working on establishing some of the first crustacean cell lines that will exist, essentially. So that's an important foundation of knowledge of what it takes to actually grow, let's say, shrimp cells outside of the shrimp body, which there's really not that much information on. Similarly, Tufts University, they really got started early on. They had some funding from New Harvest, which is another nonprofit that funds research in cellular agriculture. And so some of the first PhD students worked at a lab there in David Kaplan's lab. And that just brought a lot of momentum into the university. They've received a $10 million grant from USDA to establish a National Institute of Cellular Agriculture, which is the largest grant awarded to cultivated meat research to date in the United States. And they also have an industry consortium that GFI is a part of that involves five other companies that essentially fund research. And it's a good example of public-private collaboration where the research that is basically voted on is guided by the industry and the people that are having hands-on problems with challenges in the industry. And so you get that feedback to get the research a little bit more targeted and translatable into the challenges that are being solved, being presented as you begin to scale up these sorts of processes. So I think those are two examples, but right now there's a lot of other examples. What we found in another important project that we work on our science and technology team is called our Alternative Protein Student Project. And so we have student chapters at universities all around the world, over 50 of them now. And what we found is that students, especially the younger generation, they tend to care a lot more about sustainability and they tend to care a lot more about animal welfare. And so they see these technologies like cultivated meat as a huge opportunity for them from a career perspective. And so they'll go to the labs that they're working in and say, like, why aren't we working on this? And basically what ends up happening is that the students convince the principal investigators in those labs to start research in those areas. And we're expanding that program. We have applications open now to welcome and onboard even more student chapters. We're now, like, I think in all six continents aside from Antarctica. So there's a lot of momentum in the academic world in terms of just getting people interested in the actually really exciting research challenges that this presents, because this is like not an easy endeavor to basically say we're going to replace meat production with cells that are grown in tanks. It's very challenging from a scientific and engineering perspective, but as a scientist, that makes it a lot of fun. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity for a young scientist to get involved and to really basically carve out their careers in this area, which is basically something that I did 6 years ago as well.
It's fantastic to hear that students are helping to drive that process and convince principal investigators to take on this research. And I love that there are open opportunities. So we'll make sure that we include the links to that. And want to acknowledge a couple of examples I mentioned with Tufts and Moat Marine Laboratory certainly resonate with me as a supporter of both of those organizations. But as you mentioned, there are many examples of the work that you're doing. Are there any other collaborations or case studies that really resonate deeply with you that you'd want to share?
Oh, so we have on our website a list of all the projects that we funded if people are interested. We also have a funding database for people that are looking for opportunities. I think out of our grant program, I think what's interesting is because we have so much control over the projects that we fund, we tend to fund things that are what you call translatable science. So things that can be taken basically developed in the lab, but then taken and commercialized. And so we've seen a ton of our scientists that we fund turn into entrepreneurs and actually spin out companies that then go on to raise 10 times the amount of funding that we initially put in. And so that leads to new jobs in the sector, that leads to new growth, et cetera. So I think that's one of the interesting things that I've been able to witness that's unique to GFI is that we've been able to identify these translatable areas of scientific interest. We fund researchers that are world-class people working in usually adjacent fields, but on technologies that are very applicable to cultivated meat. And then they go out and start their own companies, which is really exciting. So I think there's some stories on our website about that, not only in the cultivated meat sector, but in plant-based as well.
We'll make sure that all this information is available for those listening. A question that seems to be getting a lot of attention in recent conversations publicly is this safety of cultivated meat. Can you talk a little bit about how safety is determined? What are the current regulatory pathways and safety considerations? And where do you see opportunities for improvement and progress?
Yeah, safety is really evaluated like any other foodstuff. And essentially how that process works. So there's been protocols and guidelines developed over decades of how to evaluate safety of food. But at a high level, essentially it works by identifying potential hazards. So what are you putting into the food? What about the process could potentially lead to a downstream hazard to the consumer? Then there's steps that are taken to mitigate those hazards. So how do we prevent those bad things from entering the system, whether it's like a piece of hair or a piece of metal falling into the food, or it's a bacteria or a fungus, stuff like that. And then finally, there's testing that you can perform to ensure the safety aspects of your food for depending on what you're evaluating. So I actually participated in an expert panel that was put together by the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization in Singapore in late 2022. And that was all about food safety aspects of cultivated meat. And the conclusion there, which is available in a lengthy public report, is that really there's nothing unique about cultivated meat that makes it more challenging to evaluate compared to other types of food, whether that's conventional meat or other like fermentation-derived foods like yogurts and things like that. So from a food safety perspective, there's not anything that's, oh, we don't know what to do here. The challenge right now instead is basically that different companies use different inputs. So different inputs into the cell culture media that the cells consume, and also different processes overall for manufacturing. And those processes tend to be unique to the food system, not necessarily unique to like medicine or pharmaceutical world. A lot of that technology is borrowed and translated into the cultivated meat industry. But nevertheless, you have regulators that are coming across something that's new, and they need to learn about it. And the way that they learn about it is by talking to companies and also evaluating the sort of safety dossiers that they put together. That basically, once you've gotten your production process up to a point where you're ready to sell to a consumer, and you put together all of the relevant information that a regulator would need to know in order to basically establish that this is going to be a safe production process. So the challenge right now is that regulators don't know exactly what questions to ask and how to do the full evaluation. We have novel foods frameworks in a lot of countries that cultivated meat can fit into, but it often has to be tweaked a little bit. And this is happening in places like South Korea, which just formalized their framework. Japan, Thailand, the UK, these are all countries that are adapting their existing, what we call regulatory framework, to fit cultivated meat so that they're ready to receive applications. And then every application, because everything's so new, it has to be independently evaluated. So there's no like single size fits all approach. And so you have countries like Singapore and the United States right now that actually have a long line of applications for products that are waiting to be approved at this point. And you have staffing issues that could be bottlenecks because in addition to cultivated meat, there's other novel foods that people are developing that also need to be evaluated. In the UK, they famously deal with an inundation of products that contain CBD, like hundreds of them are just waiting in line to be approved. And so it becomes difficult to get these products approved in a timely manner. So how can that be alleviated? I think, first of all, education is really important. So what the FAO has been organizing is in different countries, you bring in producers of cultivated meat or other fermentation-derived products. You have them meet directly with the regulators and learn, how are you doing this? What are you making? What is the manufacturing process look like? Because otherwise, as we talked about, there's not a lot of information in the existing public literature. And that information that is out there doesn't necessarily mean that's how it's produced in the real world. Like, these are just labs that are making cells and evaluating them. It looks a lot different in a commercial USDA regulated facility. And so you really need to have the companies talking to the regulators and educating them. And this is happening all over the world right now. There's also discussions around, can we whitelist certain common media ingredients? So just things like glucose and amino acids, things that we know are safe nutrients, but manufacturers and suppliers need to get those sort of approved themselves from a regulatory perspective. And then the manufacturers of cultivated meat can then go buy those reagents, and basically say, look, I've got amino acids from supplier X. You've already approved this happening in this facility that's regulated. And then you could decrease the complexity and amount of time that it's going to take to conduct the evaluation. So that's the current state of things. Different countries are in different stages, let's say, of evaluation and readiness for approving these products. Just to summarize, I think where we're at today, as I mentioned before, we have three countries that have approved products. We have Singapore, the United States, and Israel. We do expect more approvals in 2024, especially in the United States and Singapore. There's also products that are under evaluation in Switzerland and the UK and Australia and New Zealand, and likely in South Korea later this year as well. And as I mentioned, the US in particular, when those products are approved, they're highly useful because you get hundreds of pages of information that is released alongside of those approvals. That's not the case in every country, like Singapore, for instance. There's different levels of opaqueness to the approval process and everything. Obviously, from a transparency perspective, I think it's better to have that information out there so people can evaluate it themselves. But we'll see how that looks several years from now as countries are constantly shifting how they're looking at this.
Thank you for giving that broader global perspective and then honing in on some of these particular very timely examples. And just to make sure our listeners understand how timely this conversation is, can you walk through some of the really important 2023 regulatory breakthroughs and how those are connecting to what you're anticipating in terms of the next steps and in 2024?
Sure. So in 2023, those were the first approvals in the United States, and that was for two chicken products produced by two separate companies. And as I mentioned, there's a lot of information that was attached to those approvals, which was really important for other companies as well to basically know, oh, this is what I should be putting in my dossier that I'm putting together for the regulator. So just to back up to the, in the United States, the FDA regulates basically the production of cultivated meat. So the biopsy, from the point of the biopsy up until the point of harvest, at which point it's turned over to the USDA. And that's for meat and poultry products. For seafood in the United States, that's regulated solely by the FDA. And so there's different sort of regulatory oversight and agencies involved in this process. But the facilities that, for instance, chicken and beef and pork will be manufactured in are USDA inspected facilities, just as they are with vegetable meat. It's basically treated just the same by the USDA when it's being manufactured. And so all of those things have happened for the first time in 2023. And so I think there's a lot of learnings, not only for other companies to pick up on, but also from the regulators themselves. You actually have people now in these facilities that are overseeing the production of these products, even though it's at very small scale right now. But they're learning more about how this actually works and how it looks. The USDA is anticipated leading into this year to announce guidance on labeling, which is an important issue that from a consumer perspective, people need to know what this is, how it's different. But there's been all different types of terminologies that have been proposed for cultivated meat, which is what GFI has been calling it. But the USDA and some of the dossiers thus far called it cell cultivated. Having that word cell in there seems to be able to maybe help consumers distinguish the difference between this and conventional meat. However, it's also confusing because everything's made of cells anyway. So there's really no great single one size fits all. And I think that will continue to evolve. But other countries around the world are also looking, I think this is important. You know, a lot of countries around the world look to the United States FDA and see what they do. And then once it's, oh, the FDA has approved this, we better get going on our own internal sort of frameworks here. And so that speeds up global regulatory processes as well. The FDA has done a lot of education for other agencies around the world that don't necessarily have the resources to think about these new technologies. Places like Brazil, for instance, other like South American countries in Africa, these places don't necessarily have all of the necessary, there's not as many companies there that they can talk to, and they don't have as many resources that we do in the United States. And these things are all additively important for accelerating the frameworks around the world and the understanding of how to evaluate safety around the world for the different types of cultivated meat products that are being produced. And I think that's really just getting going. As I mentioned, there's a lot of products waiting in line. We're waiting still on the first seafood product to be approved. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting things that will happen in 2024. But yeah, it's been a little bit slower than what I might have expected, to be honest. I think a lot of companies are a little bit disappointed in the amount of time that it's taking. So that's something to watch out for. On top of the political sensitivity that now exists in states around the United States, thinking about actually banning the technology outright, as well as different countries around the world that have proposed legislation to ban not only the production, but also research into the technology, which is just another level of, I think, protectionism and absurd.
Can you say a little more about the bans and how that's being managed at this point?
Yeah, so I think as one of the domino effects of having these products actually enter the marketplace is then you start getting the existing industry more scared, and then they start to fight back. And so I think what you're seeing now in the United States are proposed bans in certain states where not only is production of cultivated meat outlawed and potentially criminal, but also research is being proposed to just be outright banned as well. And that in certain countries in Europe and South America as well, this tends to fall into this sort of, we need to protect our existing industry. We need to keep our tradition. We might be just afraid of technology. So I think there's a growing amount of pushback now for cultivated meat as it becomes more predominant in the marketplace. I say predominant, like it's out there. And funny that there's these like bans going on when these products are barely even on sale anywhere. But nevertheless, that is a current situation that will, I think, continue to play an important part of the evolution of cultivated meat and how fast things can ultimately happen.
Thank you for that context. I know you've talked a little bit about the state of the industry and research. To your point about availability, can you speak a little more to where is cultivated meat today and where do you see this going this year and beyond?
Yeah, I think it's really important for people to understand that the production of cultivated meat around the world today is basically measured in kilograms. So maybe a couple hundred, couple thousand kilograms. And you compare that to the hundreds of millions of tons of conventionally produced meat and seafood. So it's a rounding error to zero right now. And it's also important to understand that the facilities that cultivated meat is produced in, the equipment that you use in terms of the bioreactors, the tanks that these cells grow in, none of that really exists on Earth. Like some of it is used to make vaccines and other pharmaceutical products, but those are high value, high margin products. And so there's very little potential to basically turn those assets into meat production facilities because they're just going to keep producing high value vaccines and drugs. And so that means that all of the infrastructure is basically going to have to be new. And so it's going to take a large amount of capital investment in order to produce great facilities that can produce thousands of tons of product every year. And then you need thousands of those facilities, just like we have thousands of farms and slaughterhouses. This is something that is going to happen over a long period of time. Obviously, we need it to happen, I think, sooner rather than later. But nevertheless, the technology right now is not certain. Scalability, there's challenges with respect to scalability. We've never grown animal cells at such large scales before. And so from an investment perspective, there's a lot of risk attached to that. And so you need to really de-risk the scale up of this industry. The first person or company that basically proves that you can begin to produce thousands of tons of this product, that's going to be really important. But until that happens, you're going to have a lot of investors that are not ready to throw hundreds of millions of dollars into the pot for something that is not really a guarantee. And again, that's why you need a lot of public support for other, let's say, capital intensive build outs of infrastructure in the renewable energy sector. We have, for instance, the Inflation Reduction Act that was passed in the United States, where that's leading to a large build out of new facilities for batteries and for other renewable energy componentry in the United States. A lot of those include loan guarantees and tax incentives and all these different sort of ways that we subsidize our existing meat production system. A lot of those things need to be ultimately switched over to these new production systems as well, or at least equalized in terms of the amount of support that is given from the public sector to these new technologies. So if we can't leave it to just the private market to figure this out, you need the public governmental support to provide capital and provide these sort of basically bridging the gap from early stage technology into something that's really commercializable and profitable. And that's in technology development, you refer to that as the valley of death, because a lot of technologies fail in terms of when you're first beginning to scale up, you need a large amount of capital investment, you need a large amount of debt financing, and then you're producing a small amount of product. And so you're going to not be profitable for a while. And so there's a lot of risk attached to that and a lot of uncertainty. And for cultivated meat, there's a lot of what you would call first of a kind facilities that need to be built. And it's, as I mentioned, it's unclear exactly how that's going to go. With nuclear technology development, you have a switch to more small modular nuclear reactors instead of these very large reactors that can cost dozens of billions of dollars and take literally a decade or more to produce. So people are saying, this hasn't been working. Let's create these small and modular facilities. But there's a company that just tried to do that. And even they were not able to get the sort of offtake agreement that you would need to finance that facility. And so then they weren't able to build the facility. And there's a lot of risk attached to doing something for the first time, especially when you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars of capital that's needed. And so that's something that I think with cultivated meat is necessary to bring the amount of volume into beyond just single restaurants in a couple of cities around the United States into like actual grocery stores or at least high-end retail stores in multiple locations. To summarize, I think your question right now, cultivated meat is basically available in like a couple of restaurants around the world in very low quantities. It's produced at the kilogram scale. There are a couple of companies that are building these first-of-a-kind facilities that I'm talking about that can produce thousands of metric tons of cultivated meat. And we expect those facilities to begin to become operational in 2025, 2026, 2027, and beyond. And so I think that's really where the rubber meets the road with some of the questions that people have around scalability. Can these companies really begin to produce thousands of tons of product in these facilities? That's when you'll know a little bit more about predicting or projecting the growth of this technology and how readily accessible it's going to be. Because in the intervening years, the scale of the production are just so small that only a couple of restaurants can be serviced by a single facility. So that's how it currently stands.
Whenever we think about the challenges, to circle back on, we started the conversation that are connected to sustainability, to what is anticipated in terms of the demand for meat exceeding available land and supply by 2050, the animal welfare concerns and more, the problems can feel daunting. And the pace of progress, as you've mentioned, can feel far too slow. And the place I always try to focus from a positive change management perspective is to think about small changes that we can make that are within our control, from a variety of different lenses. So I'd love to kind of wrap up our conversation looking at this from a few different vantage points, as I think many of our listeners are absolutely on board with recognizing the sustainability benefits, the benefits to human health, the benefits to animals and more, and would want to support this. But when we think about current state of things, right? There's much that goes beyond the individual level. But if we start with students, to your point about students helping to drive the conversation with principal investigators and advancing the research, let's start there. What can students do who are inspired by this conversation, who are interested in the work that you're doing? We'll make sure the links to everything you've discussed and more are included. But how can students take what they've heard today, take what they're learning from your website, and put that into positive action?
Yeah, I get emails from students every week at this point, multiple people reaching out. I think there's a lot of students often feel a fear of missing out. They often feel like, oh, this is all happening so fast. And is there going to be opportunity for me in 6 years? Should I do a PhD? Or what's going to be on the other side of that? So I think what I tell people is that this is just beginning. There's going to be a lot more opportunities 6 years from now than there are today. I think that much is almost a certainty. I think what's interesting about cultivated meat is that it's so interdisciplinary. I have a background in stem cell biology. I was trained as a neuroscientist, but did a lot of my work in the context of disease modeling for neuromuscular diseases like ALS. And that I learned a lot about cell culture, cells, cell lines, cell culture media. But that's just like one tiny piece of the puzzle in terms of the scientific interdisciplinary world that cultivated meat is. You can have interests. You don't have to be a technical person. We need technical people on the biology side. We need people in biochemistry, in engineering, mechanical engineering, chemical engineering. But we need food scientists as well to actually make these products. We need people that are in the social sciences to understand the demand and what sorts of socioeconomical changes and implications this technology might have. You need people working on environmental impact analysis to understand what, you know, what we should be doing from a practice perspective, from an input perspective. All of these different things come together on the policy side of things as well. There's a lot to do. Obviously, you mentioned the need for public support, and that basically is derived from policy changes, both at the federal and your state and local levels. So you can have an impact in a variety of different ways there. And I think, you know, basically what I say in talks that I give, especially to students, is that I think the most important thing from a career perspective is that you're doing something that you are good at, but also that you feel is good for the world. And that from a vocational perspective, you're going to feel fulfilled. And so cultivated meat is interesting because a lot of people come at it from, they might say it's driven by animal welfare or sustainability or human health or just scientific curiosity. But there's all of those worlds that sort of intersect, and you can really align your values with your work and your vocation in cultivated meat. There's a Japanese term called ikigai that is summarizes this sort of reason for being. So you can get paid for what you're good at, but also what the world needs, etc. And so I think cultivated meat for a lot of people fits. That's how I got into it and transitioned my career. And I think a lot of students sympathize with that of wanting to basically do something that has a bigger impact on the world. And to me, there's really nothing bigger and more important than this. That's so multidimensional for different problems that the world is facing. So yeah, pursue your passion. I think that's the takeaway.
I think that the ikigai concept is one that we can all find something that resonates with us, that when we think about how all those pieces come together, we can look at where we're achieving some element of ikigai in our lives and where we want more of that. And I think we continue to hear more and more interest in finding that type of alignment across one's career. So certainly includes students and includes faculty and those working in industry and parents and others with a variety of different areas of focus. When we think about the points you just raised, policy is one that for many people can sound like it's not an area that they can contribute to, when in actuality, at least if I'm taking a U.S.-centric lens for a moment, there are a variety of different ways to share thoughts and perspectives in support of this work and to connect with one's own legislators. Can you speak a little bit to resources GFI offers and or advice you would have for those interested in helping to support from a policy perspective?
Yeah, so I think we have a whole policy team and department at GFI because policy is just one of these important pillars like that you need to happen. Generally, what happens with technology development can only go so far. You really need policy to begin to supercharge that, to get it actually out into the real world. And so the policy that we focus on is mostly to do with getting more public funding into these technologies and also advocating for fair regulation and labeling laws, for instance. So basically, I think what You know, I'm an outside observer into the policy realm. I think what I would say is the most important thing is education. The people that sit in Congress, state or federal Congress, there are very few people that even know what the hell this is. And yet special interests can pass laws that you're going to vote on party lines or whatever it may be. And so the most important thing I think that can begin to deflect that at least is just education. So talking to your family and friends, word of mouth is really important. Writing letters to the people in your state legislatures and things like that. Sharing reliable, robust information is a good way, I think, as a starting point to contribute. Yeah, that seems to be the biggest bottleneck that I observe, but I'm sure there's some of our other policy people at GFI would have maybe more astute observations of how you can directly contribute.
Thank you for sharing that. I saw you had recently been promoting some open opportunities that people can apply to, including grant funding opportunities. Can you talk a little bit about some of the ways people can look to engage with you, your work, and GFI directly?
Yes, as I mentioned, GFI, we're a nonprofit organization. Everything that we produce is basically open and out there. We have so many resources on our website that people get overwhelmed. I get overwhelmed with tracking all of them now, but definitely encourage people to spend time on the website. As I mentioned, we have a policy team, but we also have a science and technology team that I'm on and also a corporate engagement team. So there's resources that basically are tailored to all these different audiences, whether you're a scientist, whether you're an investor, whether you're a company, whether you're an entrepreneur, whether you're just a curious individual that's looking to get educated. That's all there. A grant program that you mentioned, yeah, we just opened our 2024 call for research proposals. And so we have very tailored calls about identifying what's a challenge in the industry and then getting proposals together and funding research that addresses that. So there's three opportunities, respectively, in plant-based meat, in fermentation, and also in cultivated meat. This year, I think applications are open until nearly the end of May. And we fund projects that are about $250,000 up to 2 year long projects. And again, this is supposed to be catalytic research where you can get a substantial amount of work done, but really bring in additional funds to carry that out into the real world. Whether that's spinning out a company or bringing on additional public research dollars to further develop the sort of knowledge base around these research gaps. And I also mentioned we are a network of organizations. We exist in the United States, spread out remotely. There's about, I think, 115 or so of us in the United States now. But we also have teams in Brazil, in Europe, in Israel, in India, and in the Asia Pacific region based out of Singapore. And so there's about another at least 100 people around the world that are working on these. And we do at a high level the same thing across all of our affiliate organizations, but a lot of that work becomes tailored into the specific regions and sensitivities of different regions in those places. And yeah, there's a lot of resources in all of those respective websites that you can check out. And there's different focus areas across our organizations. For instance, Europe is just such a politically diverse place. So a lot of the work that our GFI Europe team does is understanding how does Italy think about this compared to France? What's the UK doing? We need people in all those different areas to advocate, but also understand the sort of political climate and other implications as well. So super interesting. You get a very unique global perspective when you're working at GFI and following our resources. So yeah, for me personally, I try to be a public facing scientist. So I'm active on Twitter. You can find me at Elliot Swartz, just my name with no spaces. On LinkedIn as well, I post specifically more about the resources that we have and the major projects. And I try to post specifically about cultivated meat. So if you're interested in staying up the data on the industry, I'm a good person, I think, to follow.
Fantastic. Anything else you want to add for our listeners that we haven't yet touched on?
Touched on so much. We could talk about this for another 5 hours, I'm sure. But it was great to be on the podcast. And we covered a lot of good ground. And I really appreciate you having me on.
Thanks so much for sharing your insight. This has been a fascinating discussion. I'm really excited to see the responses we get. We'll make sure The links are included and shared. And thanks so much for joining today, Elliot.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining this episode of the Compassionate and Beneficial Living Podcast. Please follow, subscribe, share your comments, share with others, and let us know what topics you'd like to hear covered next.